It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's Christmas with the domestic goddess. But she's a goddess who breaks the rules. I'm talking about England's Nigella Lawson, the most lusty yet pragmatic cook we know. Now, she talks the feast, but her key to success? It's not all about us. It's Christmas in New Mexico with the Stearns. They're in an adobe hut up in the hills. Andrea Immer of TV's Simply Wine fame talks Sippin' the Sweet Ones, wines to eat dessert by. Chris Kimball from America's Test Kitchen brings us his mercilessly tested gadget picks. And we talk a boy's first dish for his mom with poet Maya Angelou. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Thank you. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today it's Christmas feasting with Nigella Lawson, England's sensationally sensual yet practical TV cook. And in true Nigella fashion, we get stylish food tips and even better, real-world philosophical ones. Well, wine maven Andrea Immer has us sipping the sweet ones, dessert wines, the babes, and the bargains. Still in a bargain mode, we get the skinny on the deals to be found in the Wine Spectator's list of the top 100 bottles of 2004. Cook's Illustrated editor Chris Kimball has his picks of stocking stuffers. Then it's cable cars, mothering, and bread pudding with poet Maya Angelou. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Hey, Jane, Michael. You know, I think one of the most romantic places that you could spend Christmas has got to be Santa Fe, New Mexico. Have you guys ever tried that?
Yes, we have. And just New Mexico in general is so perfect for Christmas, if only for the fact that they have red chilies and green chilies. And so they're kind of doing this Christmas motif all year long.
It's also just beautiful. The sky, the sun, the light. I mean, the whole thing. It's...
Well, the natural environment is so right for it. And then, of course, the way they decorate things around Christmas time is so magical. Those luminaria or farolitos, as they're called, those little lanterns, those candles in paper bags that decorate all the front yards. It's really a kind of magical fairy tale look to the place.
Do you have a particular place that you like to eat right around that time of year when you're there?
We actually do. And it's actually called El Farolito.
Oh, the little light.
The little lantern. And it's in El Rito, New Mexico, not actually in Santa Fe.
It's quite a trip from Santa Fe, in fact. It's maybe 40 minutes. You go northwest of Española, across the River Chama, into the Carson National Forest. And you think, there couldn't be anything to eat out here. But sure enough, you come to the teeny-weeny town of El Rito. One street, one restaurant, and that one restaurant is El Farolito, which looks like, it almost looks like a double-wide house trailer covered in adobe. In fact, it isn't, but it's just a tiny little place. Mm-hmm. The Trujillo family runs it. It's their recipes. They cook, they serve, and it's just real New Mexican food.
And, you know, of course, because it is Christmas and because it's New Mexico, you absolutely need to begin with a bowl of their red or green chili. The green chili is green chilies that have been roasted.
Right.
And little tiny tender bits of pork, little tomatoes, and ribbons of the hot chili. It is so good.
And just in broth, right?
Yeah, it's almost clear. Whereas the red chili, you wouldn't necessarily eat a bowl of red chili as a course. It's more like for dipping your tortillas or for putting onto a burrito. I mean, you can get the red chili with ground beef or beans added to it, but most people just get it on the side as sort of a dipping or pouring sauce.
I don't know what it is about most of New Mexico, but whenever Michael and I go out there, which is quite often, I have a real spiritual epiphany. I mean, at one point I got out on Route 66 and I started running and flapping my arms like an eagle.
And I have photographs of this too, I want you to know.
But I've come to think that it's not so much spiritual epiphany, it's lack of oxygen because of the high altitude.
You're at 7,000 feet, exactly.
Exactly.
Hey guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Arbolito, tengo 7 años. Tengo pecas, yo te los regalo. Viene mamacita con luces y esferas para vestirte y ayudo, pero no me deja con los ahí secos.
The Stearns are authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, they're here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, not to be copycats, but we are doing our own road food thing, but it's in Italian. Next spring, we're heading to Italy. We're taking a trip to Tuscany and to Emilia-Romagna. Now, this is the region Italians call the culinary capital of the country, and you can do it too. Find the details on the trip on the website, splendidtable.org. Oh, and one other thing. Check out on the site our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. Now, every week, we send you a quick recipe for worknight supper, and best of all, thanks to those cows, it's free. Now, you can register for it online on that website, splendidtable.org.
I really can't stay.
Betty, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
Betty, it's cold out there.
This evening has been
hoping that you drop in.
So very nice.
I'll hold your hand. They're just like
my mother.
Andrea Immer is one of a handful of women to earn the Master Sommelier title. Think of this as a PhD in wine. Now, in spite of the high-flying background, Andrea has a down-to-earth approach to understanding the grape. Now, you've probably seen her wine show on TV, Simply Wine, and you've probably seen her books. Andrea's latest is Everyday Dining with Wine. Andrea, it's good to have you back.
Thanks. Great to be back.
I want to talk about dessert wines because, you know, this is the time of year you kind of linger at the table and you want to end the meal with something special. But it's not the kind of thing we buy every day. So can explain dessert wines to me. What's out there? What should we look for?
Well, there are some great categories. I kind of break it down into categories because they're all the dessert wines fall into one of a handful of styles.
Uh-huh.
So, and they're really all interesting and very different, and all they all stand on their own, but they're also fun to pair with desserts and even savory foods. So, first of all, the categories that you'll see most commonly are ice wines, and those are made from frozen grapes.
Uh-huh.
And then fortified wines, and fortify means to strengthen. So there they add additional alcohol to preserve the wine and also to allow it to oxidize very slowly so that it develops a caramel enriched sort of toffee type character that is to die for.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last category is late harvest wines. And literally that means they are harvested. The grapes are harvested or picked later. Leaving them on the vine longer means there's more sugar in the grapes, therefore more richness and a honeyed kind of character in the wine. So those are the three categories, and we can kind of talk about how they differ in style because they all taste different.
So what do they taste like then?
Well, ice wine is exciting. They press the frozen grapes so that most of the water content remains in the press and only what gets fermented is this luscious, pulpy juice. And when they ferment it, the taste is extremely both sweet and tangy at the same time. I'm going to say kind of like a Jolly Rancher candy where you get really sweet fruit taste, but then you get that zip of acidity. So when you taste it, even though it's sweet, it never tastes cloying because that acidity just sparks your mouth like fireworks.
This sounds like something that would be great if you were just serving a bowl of good apples.
Exactly. It's wonderful with fresh fruit and also with cheese because that acidity sort of cuts through kind of cheese's richness. So you get a real nice counterpoint.
Okay. Now the next kind was what? The
fortified.
Okay.
Fortified wines. So here, these are wines like port from Portugal. And then also another Portuguese fortified wine that people should look for because it's a great deal is Madeira. And you're looking for a style called Rainwater Madeira. And that's just a proprietary name. It doesn't mean they've added rainwater to the wine. But what you get with these wines is a really rich, dense, either a red fruit character like plums and berries, or you'll get a dried and caramel and sort of cooked fruit character like apples that have been baked into a tart. And so they go, if you think about berry fruits and then caramel toffee type flavors, they go wonderfully with chocolate. I mean, just incredible. And simple chocolate and a great wine like this, you, oh, gosh, you don't even need dinner. But
yeah, yeah. I'm also, I can't help think of this hot fudge sundaes for some reason come to mind.
Yes, yes. Or those warm flourless chocolate cakes that ooze in the middle.
Yeah,
yeah, baby.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Okay,
exactly.
Now we're hungry. So those are wonderful, and they're not expensive. So look for port or for rainwater Madeira. And these are wonderful to have around at the holidays because they're strong, so a little goes a long way. And when you reseal the bottle, they will stay fresh for weeks because that fortification makes gives them preservative value. See, if you don't finish it, it's no sweat.
All right, now late harvest is the third category, right?
Yes, late harvest, so they pick the grapes later. You're going to look for these coming especially from Washington State's Columbia Valley. Chateau St. Michel and Hoag Cellars in some of the wineries up there make really nice ones. And they usually use the Riesling or Gewürztraminer grapes. And then they pick them late and press them. And once they're fermented, they taste not like fresh fruit, which is what wine tastes like, but like fruit that's been stewed or cooked or compoted. So you get that extra richness, sort of like instead of fresh fruit preserves or fruit tart.
Mm-hmm.
And they're wonderful, again, with cheeses and then also with fruit desserts themselves because their acidity is a little bit softer than the ice wines. So if you've got a wonderful apple pie recipe that you're making this season, these are the wines to put with that.
How do these wines work with other savory dishes? What else could I pair them with?
They're so much fun. With the ice wine and the late harvest style wines, they are a fantastic thing to pair, and you can go two directions. One of them is with charcuterie type things like cured meats and pâtés, because that meatiness is a really beautiful, total utter contrast to the rich fruit flavor of the wines.
Mm-hmm.
And then the acidity cuts through the fat of that kind of fare. And so that's a really nice thing to have on an appetizer buffet. And it'll knock people's socks off because they'll be like, wow, sweet wine, savory food, oh my God. But they'll taste it and realize this really works. And then the other thing that they pair beautifully with is shellfish dishes because of the inherently sweet flavor of shellfish, whether that's shrimp or lobster or scallops. Once you make it into a bisque or a salad or even like just a lobster or shrimp spread or canapé, pairing them with wines like that is, just so good.
Hey, Andrea, thank you, and happy holidays.
You too. Thanks.
Wine Authority, Andrea Immer is author of Everyday Dining with Wine. Now, you can get her recipe for bittersweet chocolate cassis truffles, great for gifts and for dessert, on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, feasting with the domestic goddess, Nigella Lawson, and great gadgets from America's Test Kitchen. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget.
Ding dong, ding, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong.
Think about this. The country whose food the world loves to hate has given us some pretty irresistible TV cooks. Now, England's the country, and her most original export since the two fat ladies is Nigella Lawson. Now, at a time when nearly every TV cook wears a chef's coat, Nigella Lawson makes no claims of being a pro. She looks like a 1950s movie queen who loves her food, and she's smart. Nigella's latest book is Feast, Food to Celebrate Life. Nigella, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk about feasting. What does that word mean to you? Because it has so many different meanings for people.
I think it does. I think for me, it means glorying in the abundance of food, which doesn't mean a huge spread. It just means piled up bowls and plates of whatever you've got. I'm actually thinking that the meal is there to be enjoyed not only for its own sake, mm-hmm. but for what it means, which is you're sharing food with someone else, or that you're actually savouring every mouthful, because you can have a feast by yourself. But I think it's not that sort of thing when you're eating while you watch TV so you don't even notice what you're eating.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost an act of contemplation, I think. You know, we have a limited number of dinners in this world.
Yeah,
I don't want to ruin
yeah.
one by just rushing through it. So even if I'm not cooking, even if I'm just going to slice some cheese with a bit of sliced tomato and put a bit of salt and pepper and maybe have some good bread with it, I want to relish every mouthful, and I actually want to enjoy the act of slicing my tomato and slicing my cheese. I know it sounds like I'm a bit mad, but I mean it, because I think you get an awful lot of pleasure that way. So a feast doesn't have to be that you've spent 24 hours non-stop stirring something.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally it does mean that.
Mm-hmm.
But what it means is that this is food that really is going to make a difference to your enjoyment of life.
You say something in the introduction to the book, Feast, that I found interesting. You say that as we do less and less cooking, and I'm going to paraphrase you, we almost deify the act.
Mm.
Doesn't that put an immense amount of pressure on us when we do cook?
Well, yes, that's why I think it's so important not to focus on, if you like, the high-end production of cooking,
mm-hmm.
that there is something about the process that can be enjoyable. The point of cooking is the end result, the meal.
Mm-hmm.
But the meaning is in the process, and that's a different thing. So I think that you have a bit to think, I know I don't cook very much, but I'm not trying to be a high-ranking restaurant chef,
yeah.
and I'm not trying to make people say, God, this is really wonderful. I'm just trying to create something that people feel welcomed and looked after and just want second helpings of, even though they're not focusing on you. And I think that's very, very important. And I think you only get that way by cooking relatively normal things fairly often. You know, a roast chicken, to me, is the best thing you can cook for someone or cook for yourself. And yet, really, all you need to do is to put a chicken in the oven. You don't need to do anything. The food does it for you. And I think it's really important to remember that kind of cooking.
You're speaking of bird, you seem to have a slight obsession with turkey. And I always think of it as being such an American dish, but you're
yes.
really crazy for turkey.
I am crazy for turkey, and I really, really gets on my nerves that people moan about turkey such a lot, because everyone eats it, you know, for Thanksgiving or for Christmas. But nevertheless, they always kind of say it's very boring and it's dry, and it doesn't have to be either.
So what do you do with it? What do you
Well, I think the best way of making sure it's not dry is I brine it, and I just make, I mean, I get a huge pan with, you know, water, sugar, salt. I do a very kind of holiday scented brine with cinnamon sticks and allspice berries and some orange, because I think orange is kind of a wonderful smell. And I leave it there for probably longer than is, you know, healthy and safe to do so. And then I manage to lug this great thing, and I put a bit of melted butter and maple syrup to make the skin crispy, because sometimes I find the brining can soggy it up a bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I just roast it, and then I eat it with more side dishes than you could believe possible. But I always say to everyone, it makes things easier, because if you've got a lot of people sharing that turkey, then in a way you don't eat that much. So although you might have 8 side dishes, you're only going to give them a dollop each. So in fact, you don't need to make a huge amount.
Yeah,
and I love that.
And a lot of them can be done ahead. So it's not
so
a big
much
thing.
Can be done ahead.
Yeah.
But I also think the one thing the English do with turkey, which I would love to encourage people to venture towards this, which is bread sauce. And I never know how to describe it to people. I always say it's like a really, really delicious sort of wallpaper paste, which I can see is not the greatest PR spin you can put on it. But it's like, it's not like a bread pudding, because it's it's cooked in a saucepan and it's savoury, but you scent or you infuse milk with an onion, a clove, some mace, and then you, and salt, it has to be quite salted, and then you put some stale bread, I just tear it off a loaf, but you can cube it or you can crumb it as you wish, and then you cook the bread in the scent, sort of scented infused milk, and then at the last bit you just stir in a small bit of butter and you eat it. It's kind of warm and it's like a relish on the side of the plate, because just in case with the stuffing and the sausages and the potatoes and the parsnips, you haven't got enough carbohydrates, you have got bread sauce. But it really is delicious. I couldn't bear to have turkey without it. And also the leftovers, so you have the next day a sandwich, cold turkey, cold cranberry sauce, as it always is, cold bread sauce, and wedged between two slices of white bread, and there's something quite transforming about the experience.
You may just start a whole new fashion.
But I'd like to know what people think of it, because I have to say, I have it always with roast chicken as well. It is what we always have with poultry in Britain.
Got to try it. I mean, on the surface, it does sound like liquid bread and butter with spice added to it. But what could be bad?
No, how can that be bad?
What are you going to be doing for these holidays?
Well, I always like a spot of baking, because I like the way it makes the house smell good. And I also feel that fruitcakes get such a bad press. I know that, you know, Calvin Trilling always says that there's only one fruitcake in the world. There's one person sending it to another all the time. Yeah. who does the rounds. Mm-hmm. But that's because sometimes people make a dry fruitcake. I make everything in a very easy way, because I get very tired around the holidays. I have two young children, and, you know, what with having to do the Christmas cake stall at their school, I'm pretty well ready to go into retirement a bit in the holidays. So what I do is I do fruitcakes that you don't have to mix in a big way. You just put everything in a saucepan and everything gets very moist, and you have heat going into all the dried fruit, the liquid. And then once you've just left that on the heat for a while and let it get really steeped, you just take it off, put in the flour and eggs, and stick it in a tin and bake it, and it makes the dampest, fruitiest cake you can believe. And that's what I'm doing a lot. And it's a lovely gift to give people. You can make very small ones and just put a few shiny fruits on tops, and, you know.
This might actually work.
I just think that anything's better than going shopping.
Nigella Lawson, thank you.
Oh, thank you. Bye.
Nigella Lawson is author of Feast, Food to Celebrate Life. Now, Nigella left us with two recipes, that bread sauce and the fruitcake, which she calls Easy Action Christmas Cake. You can find them both online, splendidtable.org. I used to think having cooks on your gift list made shopping easy. For not a lot of money, you could find them a great gadget. Well, that was before the floodgates broke. Pick an item, like a garlic press, and see maybe 10 different kinds in the shops. Now, somewhere in that mess is an exceptional one, but how to find it? Well, that's a puzzle. Enter Cook's Illustrated magazine and its creator and editor, Christopher Kimball. They take no advertising, and they ruthlessly test drive kitchen stuff. Chris, welcome.
My pleasure.
Chris, we're coming to you looking for stocking stuffers. So this year at Cook's Illustrated, which gadgets have you really liked?
And they have to fit in a stocking, too, I guess.
Yeah, ideally. Right? In the best of all possible worlds, yes.
No $250 standing mixers here. Well, we test these all the time, and a lot of gadgets simply don't work very well. But here's a list of stuff that we really, really liked, and we actually use in our test kitchen. Messermeister came out with a peeler about a year ago that will actually peel a tomato or peel a peach.
That means it's really sensitive.
Yeah, and, you know, instead of putting a tomato or peach in boiling water and then ice water to peel it with a paring knife, it actually works. So Messermeister peeler is one of those rare gadgets that does what it says it'll do. OXO, which makes a lot of kitchen gadgets, has a wonderful peeler with a large handle, which has been out for years. But they just came out with one with replaceable blades like a razor. And also the handle's slightly less wide, which we liked. So that's actually a good thing, because you can replace a dull blade, which, of course, in the past, you probably just threw it out when you got to the dull stage. Mm-hmm. The Adjusta cups, there's a couple of them. We like the Kitchen Arts one in particular. If you're measuring molasses, honey, sour cream, it's kind of hard to do. And these push-up Wonder cups, or in this case, Adjusta cup, allows you to do, I think, up to 2 cups. And it gives you a perfect measurement, and it's you get all of it out. It doesn't stick to the insides because there's a plunger that pushes it up.
How does it work exactly? Is it a matter that
basically it's a tube that has a plunger in it. It's like a huge syringe. And you pull the plunger down to, the, let's say, a cup. There's measurements on the side. You line it up at the right amount, fill it to the top, and then simply push the plunger in, and it pushes the sour cream or molasses or honey out the other side.
It's one of those things that you wish you had thought of. It makes so much sense.
Somebody's sitting in the Bahamas right now, yes, enjoying the rest of their life.
Exactly.
Garlic presses are boring, and no self-respecting chef would use one, except we like them, especially the Zyliss, Z-Y-L-I-S-S. It actually works. You can even leave that sort of papery outer peel on the clove. It will remove it for you. And actually, when you use a garlic press, you get more garlic flavor because you're breaking down the cell membranes more than you would for a mince, for example. So Zyliss garlic press is one that works, and many other brands we tested actually don't work that well. Most people don't know that ovens are usually way off. If you set your oven for 350, we know it could be 300, it could be 390. That obviously can affect baking fairly substantially. the oven thermometers you buy for $5 at the supermarket don't work too well. Taylor makes one that's horizontal. It's nice and stable on the rack. It has a blue alcohol inside, so it doesn't have mercury. It's actually quite good, and we suggest you use that every time you use your oven. Polder makes a wonderful little timer. It's horizontal. It's very small, very light. And it comes on a string, and you can actually put it around your neck. So if you're like me and you get a phone call, the kid has a problem, or someone comes to the back door, you can keep the timer with you, and then you know when your baked goods should be turned around in the oven.
Oh, this is great.
Thermopen makes a very, very expensive digital thermometer, which costs about $80. Comes now in a variety of colors. I think King Arthur Flower Company sells them, among other people. But it's extremely accurate, has a long probe so you can get into the middle of a roast, for example, and has a huge digital readout, so it's easy to read. Very accurate. We use them in the test kitchen. We must have 20 of them. Again, they're expensive, $80, but they're worth the money.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's say you do want a big splurge gift. What would be your choice?
A big splurge gift for me would probably be a custom-made knife. There's some places that make them in the country. One guy's out in Seattle, and he makes beautiful handles of different woods, and the knives are really exceptional. So for someone who does cook a lot, that would be high on my list. Other things, I would think probably a good gift, which isn't that expensive, are the new Japanese knives, the Santuco knives. We've tested those as well, and they're $40 or $50.
Mm-hmm.
And those are very good. They have very thin blades, and they're very good for vegetables, for thin slicing. And that's a gift that most people don't have, and it's a very sharp knife. It's a good knife.
Well, this is great. Hey, have a great holiday, Chris, and thank you.
You too. I'll be busy with my timer. No one to open my presents.
Christopher Kimball is editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Now, we posted his gadget picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, if you're like me, Bargain Hunter is your middle name. I'm always looking for a score, especially in the wine shop. One place to begin the hunt is the Wine Spectator magazine. Now, this time of year, it publishes its list of the top 100 wines of the past 12 months. Now, we have the Wine Spectator's executive editor on the phone, Tom Matthews. Tom, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Lynn.
So, Tom, I understand that you started with 12,500 wines.
That's how many we reviewed during the course of 2004.
How did you get this down to 100 bottles?
Well, it's a very sharp winnowing stick. It would have been easy just to take the top 100 scores, but we're trying to do something a little more ambitious than that.
Mm-hmm.
We want to give people a sense of the excitement of the wine world this year, and we want to measure that excitement on a number of criteria. Score and its quality is only one of them. value is very important. As you said, everybody wants to get a bang for their buck.
Right.
Also, we look for wines that are made in big quantities because it's tougher to make a great wine in big quantities than in tiny ones. And finally, we think about something we call the X factor of excitement. What exciting happened in the world of wine this year, and what wines exemplified that? And I think that is part of the reason behind our Wine of the Year.
Now, what is the Wine of the Year?
This year, for only the second time in 18 top 100s, we picked a white wine. It's Chateau Riosec, a Sauterne from the region of Bordeaux in 2001. Sauterne is a sweet wine, dessert wine, kind of out of favor these days, but has roots going back centuries. Was the wine of kings in the 18th century, and 2001 was a fantastic vintage. This wine rated 100 points from us. Perfect.
That's an incredible score from you guys.
Yep.
What does it taste like?
Well, it tastes like honey, but honey with the added dimension of ripe fruit, exotic spices, and the leavening agent of alcohol.
How much does that sell for?
Well, when it was originally released as futures, it was only $40. When we rated it, it was still $80. Now that it's Wine of the Year, it's $160.
Oh, boy. Could we talk bargains now?
Yes.
Just, you know, okay. Is there anything in the $20 and under range?
Well, in fact, about a third of the wines on the list are at $20 and under, and there are 13 at $15 and under.
Oh, boy. Can you give us some ideas of what those are?
I thought I'd just give you five quick hits.
Okay, good.
First, two American standouts, because that's what we mostly drink here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
A Chardonnay from Chateau Souverain, their Sonoma County 2002. That rated 91 points and only cost $14. Sonoma is great for Chardonnay. It's cool enough. It's warm enough. They have the right soils, and Souverain is excellent at making value wines, not only Chardonnays, but others, too.
Mm-hmm.
From Washington State, one of America's most delicious Merlots, the Columbia Crest Columbia Valley Grand Estates, 90 points, $11. Merlot is kind of Washington's signature wine, and it's a way to look beyond the familiar California. Then I thought a couple of Australians, because as you may know, Australia is now the number two country in terms of wine sales in the U.S. behind only Italy.
Hmm.
They make great Chardonnays, too, and the Rosemount Hunter Valley Show Reserve 2002, 90 points, $15, is ripe fruit, round on the palate, just a sheer pleasure to drink.
Mm.
And then Shiraz, also known as Syrah in France, is their big red. And the Peter Lehman Barossa Valley 2002, which was rated 90 points and cost $15, is a good example. It's ripe and generous with blueberry and espresso fruit flavors. Finally, I picked one in honor of you, Lynn, from Italy.
Thank you.
It's a Suave. Now, Suave was big in the 70s, and then it turned into industrial Blanc. But some wineries are really making it a great wine from this white region in the Veneto. Inama makes a Suave Classical 2002 that scored 90 points, cost only $13, and it really is a beautiful, fruit-friendly, clean, crisp, round white wine.
Tom, what an interesting list. Hey, thank you for sharing it.
It's my pleasure, and I hope it'll encourage people to explore the whole world of wine.
Mm, thanks. Thomas Matthews is executive editor of the Wine Spectator magazine. Well, to get Thomas's bargain picks, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, guys, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, in Italy, who decides if you've been naughty or nice? And it's not Santa Claus. Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, in Italy, who decides if you've been naughty or nice? Well, it's not Santa Claus. It's La Befana, a crotchety old woman. Now, if you've been good, she fills your stocking with toys and sweets. And if you've been bad, you get hunks of coal. Of course, there's a backstory here. Now, in Italy, traditionally, you got presents not on Christmas, but on January 6th, the Epiphany, the day the wise men found the manger in Bethlehem. Now, the story goes that the wise men were on their way to Bethlehem, and they stopped at La Befana's farm. They told her about this remarkable child that they were tracking, and they invited her to join them. Well, she didn't believe a word. In fact, she told them she couldn't just drop everything to go on a wild goose chase. Besides, she had too much housework to do. Well, of course, they were right, and she was wrong. Now, every January 5th, once it gets dark, La Befana climbs on her white donkey and hauls up a big sack of presents. She goes from house to house, leaving gifts, hoping that in one of them, she's going to find the baby Jesus. Now, children leave out Epiphany sweets to cajole La Befana. The sweets are different in every part of Italy. Now, one of my family's favorites comes from near their part of Tuscany, the Vasilia area. There, farm women make this apple citron turnover. It's a big half moon bursting with fruits. Kind of a hint to La Befana of what the kids hope to find in their stockings. Now, the recipe for apple citron turnovers on the website, splendidtable.org. And if you leave some out for La Befana, you just might get lucky.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can't be so warm and tender, call me.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Jeff on the line from Memphis. Hey, Jeff, what do you want to talk about?
How are you doing?
I am swell.
Wonderful. I was actually calling with a question regarding the holiday turkey. I've heard people talk about soaking them in a brine for a couple days before cooking them, and I was seeing if you guys recommended this, and if so, what procedure would I use in order to end up with a successful holiday bird?
Well, first of all, where are you? I hear it sounds like there's a party going on in the background.
It's actually not a party. I'm at my restaurant. It's in the middle of our lunch hour. However, it was a question that I was eager to ask, so I thought I would put everything on hold in order to call in.
Oh, that's lovely. But okay, brining a turkey. Here's what you need. You need a container that can hold the bird plus about 3 inches of cold water.
Okay.
You need a place where you can keep it cold, because you're in Tennessee, and unless you can keep it at like 32 degrees, I don't want you having, you know, bad bird.
Absolutely.
So you need a place that you can keep it refrigerated. And then what you do is, for every gallon, that's 4 quarts of cold water, you want to have a half a cup of kosher salt, a half a cup of brown sugar, and whatever seasonings you think you're going to like. For instance, if you think you love garlic, for every gallon, I would do the half cup, and maybe 10 crushed cloves of garlic.
Okay.
If you want a spicy turkey, I would do the half cup, and then I would do like a quarter cup of ground pure chili powder. Maybe not super hot. It
right.
depends on how much spice you want. But the idea is you overdo the spicing because it's going to be absorbed into the bird. Now, for what I usually do, because I don't like my bird to taste pickled, a lot of people will tell you to do it for 4 or 5 days.
Right.
And I'm sorry, that's pickled bird. You know,
absolutely.
That's going too far. I would do it
either for 24 hours or at most 36 hours.
Okay, so roughly a day in advance.
Yes, exactly. And of course, the bird's got to be completely defrosted.
And so does the brining process alter the cook time of the turkey?
No, it doesn't alter the cook time, but what happens is it absorbs the moisture, the salt, essentially it's being preserved. The salt ends up in the flesh along with moisture. So it plumps the bird and it gives you a lot of leeway. In so many words, it's much harder to get a dry turkey when you've brined it. So essentially doesn't alter the cooking time. The cooking time is going to be about the same.
Okay, and so cook until an internal temperature of about 165?
That's right, 165 in the thickest part of the thigh.
Excellent. Well,
and then one other thing, big thing, give it a 20-minute rest at least.
Before carving.
Before carving. If you want to let that turkey sit for 30 or 40 minutes, that's even better because it continues cooking during that time and all the juices settle. And also, that gives you time to make the gravy and all the other stuff.
Right.
Okay?
Wonderful. Thank you, Lynn.
You are more than welcome. Have a great holiday.
And you do the same.
Okay. Bye. Take care. You can reach us, guys, 800-537-5252. You know, we've come to a point now that if you think anything is going to be dry and tough in the meat world, brine it. Just brine it. That's it. Let's see, who's up next? We have Marianne calling from Minneapolis. Hey, Marianne, what do you want to talk about? What's up?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I was told that Marcona almonds were something that was really delicious.
Right,
and
right.
I was on a trip to New York City, and I picked some up for my husband. And when I got home and we tried them, I realized that they were raw. And so they weren't very tasty. And I'm trying to figure out if there's something else that I can do with those almonds.
Well, let's see now. Now, just for everyone who's not familiar with them, Marcona almonds come from Spain, and they're almost heart-shaped, aren't they? They're kind of stubby.
Right, right.
And they can be really delicious. Now, of course, so many things influence how a nut tastes, you know, like how old it is, where it came from. But if you toast a nut, 90% of the time, you're going to give it more flavor. So if these are raw, what most people are raving over is the roasted version of them.
Okay.
And if we're going to be very Spanish about this, toss them with a small amount of olive oil that has a good flavor.
Okay.
And coarse salt. And then I'd put them in a slow oven, like 325 degrees for maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes. And the idea is you want to slow roast them and they get really crunchy, but spread them out in a big pan.
Okay.
So that there's, you know, not that obviously they may be touching, but you don't want to stack them. You want to essentially dry them out so they're really crisp. And I'd set a timer for 10 minutes, taste one, and then maybe go another five and then another five.
And should I turn them?
Yeah, stir them every so often.
Okay.
But
okay.
Coarse salt and a little bit of olive oil. And, you know, I don't think anyone would slap your hand if you added just the smallest amount of brown sugar.
Oh, okay.
Because it'll help them caramelize or at least get a little brown. And the other thing is that little bit of sugar, I'm talking about at most maybe a teaspoon for a big pile of, let's say, a whole pound of almonds, is just going to give it that little edge. You don't want sweetness. You want that little edge.
Right, right. Okay.
Hey.
Sounds great.
Hey, take care.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
By the way, talk about something that's great to have around the house during the holidays. One of the things I've done with that is I add orange zest and fresh rosemary to that mix. So it's a lot of coarse salt and a little black pepper and fresh orange zest and just rosemary needles. Fabulous. Slow, slow roast. Okay. Who's up next? By the way, you can reach us, 800-537-5252. Okay, we have Ralph up next. He's from Vernon Hill, Virginia. Hey, Ralph, what's up?
Hey, Lynn, how you doing?
I am doing swell.
Nice to talk with you. I've got a cooking chicken 101 question.
Okay,
okay. So simple. But I guess I'm thinking about being rushed in the kitchen, and I get a package of chicken from the grocery store or the market, or I get a recipe book, and it says the first thing you do is wash the chicken pieces and pat them dry.
Right.
My answer is, why am I washing this chicken? It's been packaged in a sanitary way, I'm sure, and I'm cooking it for like an hour in the oven. Why am I washing the chicken? I don't wash steak. I don't wash pork chops.
Well, some people would say maybe we should.
Oh, okay.
But we don't necessarily have to go there.
Right.
Generally, it's because, and by the way, this could be true of almost anything. When things sit in an airless, you know, sealed environment, sometimes certain bacteria can develop. I'm not saying the food is dangerous. It isn't. But when you rinse it off, you rinse off sometimes things that might have off flavors. You rinse off surface bacteria, and then you pat it dry. You're getting rid of stuff that might compromise the flavor or just might be a little harmful. But the reality is, you're right. You're putting this in an extremely, you know, hot environment. But I like to do it because sometimes if you sniff that chicken as it comes out of the package, sometimes there's just a, I can't explain that. I think of it as a store aroma. It doesn't smell bad. Yeah, but by rinsing it, I get rid of it. So I guess you don't have to, but it's not a bad idea to do it. The roof will not cave in if you do not.
That's what I thought. So it's nice to do, but not totally necessary.
Not 1,000% essential, but I just like to rinse. I just feel a little better about things.
Okay, I'll do the same.
And also, by the way, the patting dry. Often there, it is moist when it's in the package. The patting dry just means it's going to brown more easily.
Oh, cool.
And less chance of
sticking. Now there's a...
yeah, because you put wet stuff into a roasting situation or into a pan to saute it, and it's going to steam. And then you don't get that nice crispness that you'd like. Right. So, but great question.
Well, thank you very much. The one-on-ones
are always great questions.
Keep the table coming.
Hey, thank you, sir. We'll do our best. Take care.
Bye-bye.
You know, it's that one of those things, it's true, it doesn't make sense, you're going to heat it anyway, but be on the safe side, guys. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Maya Angelou stands high on my list of extraordinary people. Teacher, mother, poet, playwright, professor, San Francisco's first black cable car conductor, and a woman who really cooks. Maya's latest book is Hallelujah, The Welcome Table, A Lifetime of Memories with Recipes. Ms. Angelou, welcome to The Splendid Table.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be sitting here at the table.
Well, you know, I thought I had a pretty good handle on most of your accomplishments, but the first black cable car driver in San Francisco, how did this come about?
Well, that was so long ago. I was 16. And I was ahead. My mother said I could take off a semester if I got a job. So I went down to apply for the job. Since I saw the women riding the streetcars, and they had the smart uniforms and those coin changers attached to their belts and bibbed caps, and they just looked so good. I didn't think that they were all white. I just thought they were women. And so I applied, and they wouldn't accept me for about 3 weeks. But I persisted, and I got the application. And my mother said, when I was refused and came home crying, she asked me, now, why do you think they didn't let you have an application? I said, because I'm black. She said, that's right. Now, do you want it? I said, yes. She said, go get it. Just go there. And so I did. About the third day, just sitting like a bump on a log, I felt such a fool. But I'd rather sit there than go home and tell my mother that I gave up. So.
Well, now, San Francisco was also the scene for one of my favorite stories from the book. You call it Lessons from a Kitchen Stool. Could you tell us that story?
Yes. My son was 6 years old, and we were between apartments. He and I lived in rooms whenever I could afford it.
Mm-hmm.
But when I couldn't, I'd go back to my mother's big house. So my mother tells it that my son Guy was six, and I had two jobs, so I was out. And he asked her to please make a dessert for me. And he just persisted. And finally she asked him, you're big enough to bully me, try to bully me into making a dessert. Why don't you make it? So he laughed and said, but I'm only 6 years old. She said, that's all right. You can make it if you want. And so she showed him how to make a bread pudding. And when I came home, he was so excited that he had said he wouldn't tell me that he did it. So when I came in the house, he said, hi, Mom, you want to eat?
you still had your coat on, right?
And when we did sit down to eat, he asked, do you like it? And of course, it was just the dinner. And he said, "Are you ready for the dessert?" He could really. He was about to pop, the poor baby. And finally, my mother brought it out, and it was a beautiful bread pudding, toasty and soft looking and all that. And she put it in front of herself to serve it. And he said, I made it for her. Let my mother serve it. And I hadn't even put it in my mouth. He asked, "Do you like it, Mom? Mom, do you like it?" And I said, "I love it. It is the best bread pudding in the world." And I think it still is.
Tell me, do you have grandchildren?
I have one grandson, and I have two great-grands.
So what do you want them to learn to cook?
Well, I want them to learn to respect food and to like it, not to love it. Because if they love it, they might overeat and indulge. But what I really wish is that they would sit down together and eat. To sit and look across the table at a son or daughter or mother or father or whoever and say, "How have you been? Well, I hope you'll have a good day. Well, what happened yesterday?" This is what I wish.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have lost something so important that it is making us brutish.
Mm. It's a perfect thought to leave us with. Thank you so much, Maya Angelou.
Thank you very much, Miss Splendid Table Casper.
Have a wonderful holiday.
And the same to you and yours. Bye.
Poet and writer Maya Angelou is author of Hallelujah, The Welcome Table, A Lifetime of Memories with Recipes. Now, there is no way we are letting that bread pudding recipe get by us. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Hey, remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. And from all of us here at the Splendid Table, to you and yours, have a wonderful Christmas. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought for the holiday. Christmas is a time when everyone wants his past forgotten and his present remembered. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to check out our weekly newsletter while you're there. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it's free. Now, something that's not free is our spring trip to Italy. It's going to Tuscany and Emilia-Romagna. Now, all the details are on the site, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great holiday. Join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.